Our culture is in a crisis, and the solution to that crisis is the gospel message. St. John's Seminary, the seminary of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, offers an online MA in pastoral ministry degree for anyone interested in receiving formation for ministry. This program helps students improve their knowledge of the Catholic intellectual tradition and develop practical skills for ministry. A studio with professional video, audio, and lighting equipment allows our students to have an enjoyable technological experience, a necessity for any online learning environment.
Anyone who is working in and around the Roman Catholic Church in North America needs an education like this. There's no way you could get this kind of education anywhere than at a seminary.
Our online Master of Arts in Pastoral Ministry offers you the chance to continue your education in ministry and designed to provide you with the knowledge, spiritual formation, and practical skills that you need to serve the family of God in our parishes, schools, and other ministries.
By grounding yourself in the intellectual tradition of the Catholic Church, you will be able to go out into this culture and leaven it with the good news. Welcome to the podcast. My guest today is a returning guest, Dr. R.J. Snell, who is the Editor-in-Chief of Public Discourse and Director of Academic Programs at the Witherspoon Institute. He earned his M.A. in philosophy at Boston College and his Ph.D. in philosophy at Marquette University. His research interests include the liberal arts, ethics, natural law theory, Thomas Aquinas, the Catholic intellectual tradition, and the work of Bernard Lonergan. He has published extensively, including a book in a previous episode from a couple of years ago that he and I talked about from 2015, Acadia and Its Discontents, published by Angelico Press, and just recently published a new book with Angelico Press, Lost in Chaos, Imminence, Despair, and Hope, which is this book is the topic of our discussion today. First of all, Dr. Snell, welcome back. Good to see you again.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate the conversation.
Your book, in short, attempts to explore what you call our hopeless age, and it tries to do several things. And I'd like to talk about each of these in turn. So the first several chapters explore what you call the three malaises of modernity. The next several chapter, you explore three visions of false hope, sort of a response to those malaises. And then the final chapter is you offer paths of recovering an authentic hope. So, sort of taking that structure, your book structure as a guide, why don't we try to follow that? So let's talk about begin by talking about your first chapter, that first of the three malaises you call radical imminence and its attendant despair. You describe this by saying that moderns consider themselves alone in this universe with no God and no advent or help. What remains is that illness, which is life, already in the inexorable trajectory toward death. Birth is the beginning of a slow death. Can you start by expanding on this idea? Where does this imminence, this radical imminence, come from? What are sort of the symptoms of it, and what are the effects or consequences of it?
Well, that's a cheery line you just read. You read it, I thought, well, boy, who wrote that? They need help. So thanks. So yeah, thank you for the summary of the book. That's right. Three sections, just as you've described. And the first is on imminence and its attendant despair. The first chapter, I really enjoy reading. Oh, that's strange to say I enjoy reading, but I really enjoy reading the fiction of the Italian novelist Elena Ferrante. It's glum. One of the reasons I like reading, no one knows who it is. It's a pen name, but we assume it's a she. One of the reasons I enjoy reading her is her fiction is fiction which starkly looks at a world in which, as she views it, religion is now absent. Some of the older forms of political hope have disappeared. So Marxism has been tried and failed. Feminism has been tried and failed. And so what's left is a kind of stark depiction of where we're at. The novella, she's most famous for the four-volume series on Naples, but the novella, which I really like, Days of Abandonment, has this intense scene of a woman who's locked in her apartment. She can't get out. The key is broken. The door is reinforced because she was afraid. cell phone is broken. She's forgotten to pay her phone bill, and so the landline's broken. And one of her children is sick, and the dog is dying. And her child keeps asking where daddy is. And her father has abandoned the family for another lover. And so at one point, just as she's entering in despair, the door knocks, and the one child says, it's daddy, full of hope, but it's not daddy. So I take that to be a pretty provocative and powerful, maybe over the top description and depiction of the way a whole lot of modern people in the West experience their lives. They're within immanence. There is no transcendence. There's no God. There's no verticality to life. When there's no verticality to life, no beyond to hope for, and when modern science has revealed to us that we're really just, chemicals, I like to call this nothing buttism, which is a line I learned from Roger Scruton. What are we? Well, we're nothing but biology. And well, what's biology? Biology is nothing but chemical. And what is chemistry? Well, it's nothing but physics. It's pretty difficult to convince ourselves that there's meaning in the world, or that there's a beyond, or there's a God. We are, in an inelegant phrase, wet robots or meat robots, and there's nothing to look forward to in the beyond. We're trapped in the room. We're trapped in immanence, in what Charles Taylor calls the immanent frame. So if you imagine a picture frame, we're inside the frame, and anything inside the frame, which is the world of physics and math, that's real. And anything outside the frame, the world of God, for instance, the world of the divine, that's not real. There's nothing there. So we're trapped in the apartment, and there's no landline or escape, no exit, to think of an old existentialist novel. That's where I think that a whole lot of people find themselves. And now they're attempting to lead human lives, the sort of lives that everyone everywhere has attempted to live. How do I determine the what I should do, how I should work, who I should marry or not marry, the meaning of romance, the meaning of children, the whole game of humanity. So Charles Taylor suggests that we live in a disenchanted age, what he calls the immanent frame. And he says there's a categorical difference between a world in which the highest human aspirations and ideals cannot be made sense of without pointing or referencing God, and a world in which the highest human aspirations and ideals can be made sense of without referencing God, or even can only be made sense of with the evacuation of God. That's a categorically different kind of human experience, he thinks. I agree. And that's where we are. That's immanence.
I haven't read it yet, but William Kavanaugh has just come out with a new book. I think it's called The Uses of Idolatry. It's sitting on my stack. I actually read the introduction, and it sounds like he wants to push back a little bit on Taylor's analysis of sort of immanence. And the buffered self is sort of the secular age.
Sure.
And I think, again, I've only read the introduction, but the argument Kavanaugh wants to make is, no, we're still just as sort of, we are a religious animal. We just d worship different things now, right? If you look historically, especially in the Judeo-Christian West, we're just worshiping idols, which of course, in one sense, is a very old story. The difference is that, when at least in the Old Testament, right, God's always still sort of lurking in the background. So I guess I'm wondering if how you would might respond to that the idea of no, we're not really in a secular age. We're still just as religious as ever. We just worship different things.
Yeah, good. Well, I look forward to reading that. I've read a whole lot of Kavanaugh's work in previous years and always found it really fruitful. He's very good. So I didn't know that book, but I'll look for it. It's certainly the case that in chapter two, I give a kind of non-critical reading of Taylor. I basically just condense his argument for my own purposes. And I'm well aware that there are objections to it. I think it's helpful as a kind of description of the scenario. Again, I haven't read Kavanaugh's book either, but I'm not sure as described that either I or Taylor would disagree with it. So Taylor does not believe in what's oftentimes thought of as the subtraction thesis of religion or the subtraction theory, that insofar as we become modern enlightened people and have modern science and explanations that don't require God, that religion is just inevitably going to be removed. So in a secular age, he says there are three kinds of secularity: secularity one, two, and three. Secularity one is essentially A non-religious, non-confessional state, some weak sense or strong sense of the separation of church and state. All right. Secularity, too, he thinks, is something like a decline in religious practice and religious observance. Fewer people go to mass, fewer people think of themselves theists, the rise of the nuns, that sort of phenomenon. Secularity, three, is not that there is not religious belief. In fact, he suggests that the contemporary state allows for a kind of supernova of religious belief, an explosion of various kinds of religion and religious belief. But his point is that the conditions of belief has changed. If you're, if you're walking around 13th century Paris with Bonaventure and Aquinas, it might be a little harder to be an atheist than it is to be an atheist in Paris of 2024. Well, why? Reality hasn't changed, but the conditions of belief have changed. How it is that we go about making sense of things. And one of the phenomena that Taylor points to is the advent of what he calls exclusive humanism. So there's been various forms of humanism in the Western story. I think of ancient Athens as a kind of humanism, Renaissance humanism, and so on. He says that what we're in now is exclusive humanism, where it's a live option, and many people believe it, to think that nothing more than merely human flourishing, meaning things like GDP and clean water and clean air, and the new iPhone, that is what it is to have a full and flourishing life. Now, that's not the only option. If you're a religious believer, you can look at a person who's an exclusive humanism, someone who thinks that there's nothing except humanism. We exclude all other considerations of the divine. And you can look at them and say, they don't have religion, but they don't appear to feel that there's a loss or lack. They have an account of human flourishing and human fulfillment. And they seem to have, in their own lights, good grounds to believe in that. And they don't seem to believe that I have good grounds for believing in the divine or a non-exclusive humanism or what have you. Now, Taylor and I think that that's perfectly compatible with what we might think of as more religion, new religion, what in one of the chapters I call kind of woo-woo, right? Spiritual but not religious. The kind of Western form, the Hollywood form of Buddhism, which is not really Buddhism. It's just a kind of mindfulness and self-development or something. You can have all sorts of religion, including what we might think of as idolatry. But, most idolatry is there as a kind of magic in order to control our fate and to control powers that we don't know how to control. So you can think of scientism. I don't mean by that science. Scientism, a religion of science, as a kind of idolatry. You can think of various forms of spirituality, which are sort of like life hacks. They promise happiness, well-being, longevity, contentment as a kind of idolatry. You have neo-paganism emerging, like real neo-paganism, right?
Right.
Not just people pretending, but people believing in Wicca or the old Norse gods or going to Stonehenge for the solstice and thinking something's happening. That's all perfectly compatible, I think, with certain aspects of Charles Taylor. And indeed, my central chapters here, I don't use the term idols, IDOLS, but I do refer to idols, IDYLLS, sort of false promises of hope that aren't the real thing. Well, I'm choosing the phrase idols because it's etymologically related to idol, but it gives a kind of, an idol is a pastoral or bucolic poem or work of art, which seems to indicate a scene of peace, but actually overlooks what's really there, right? That there's some darkness or something untamed to reality. So I just don't see those as being especially incompatible, although there's certainly a difference of emphasis in Taylor from what I'm speculating where Kavanaugh is going.
The second of your three malaises of modernity you describe as the loss of value. You say that moderns who have confidence in their ability to master their lot in faith, to control fortune, but the malaise of mastery results in a frenzy of anxiety and an exaggerated sense of responsibility. Let's explore that a little bit more deeply. What do you mean by that? And what value is being lost here?
Thanks. So I think there's a kind of odd paradox in the modern project. So I really like the work of Remy Brog and Pierre Manent, who insist that whatever else modernity is, it's a project. It's a sense that we have a task that we're going to bring about. But the modern project has as one of its underlying assumptions and commitments the notion that humans, this is Taylor's phrase, are now buffered. We're sort of autonomous from forces of magic out there in the world. The evil eye, the hex, and the sacraments don't really enter us. They can't do anything to us. We're free from the forces of demons, goblins, and angels and gods. So we're free. And what we find is a universe that is basically just force, which we can control, we can master through our scientific understandings. Okay, so far, so good. We have a kind of freedom. There comes with that, though, an enormous responsibility, which is we can't blame God for anything. You know, so I make reference at one point to that very oddly comforting passage in the Gospels where Jesus is asked why the man born blind is blind. Is it his sin or the sin of his parents? And Jesus says, no one's sin, but that the power, the glory of God could be manifest. Well, that's a very strange comfort. Well, okay, the guy's still blind, so the God's glory can be manifest. But on the other hand, God's at work there. It's no one's fault. God is at work, providence and so on. Well, there are no more acts of God. So why is the man blind? Well, he's blind because of disease. Why is there disease? Because we haven't cured it yet. Can we in principle cure it? Yes. It's not the result of the fall. It's not the opening of Pandora's box. It's not the will of God. It's he has a disease. We should cure that. We can cure that. And if we can, we ought. Okay. There's no intentionality in the universe other than the intentionality that we provide. But our intentionality is just the result of matter in motion, evolutionary spirit, and so on. So the meaning of all of that is up in the air. There is no real and fundamental meaning. But the minimizing of suffering, the bettering of our lot, that's all open to my mastery. So I cite Yuval Noah Harari from Homo Deus. Man works, wakes up at the dawn of the 21st century, stretches and says, well, what's on the agenda for the day? Well, let's get rid of plague. Let's get rid of famine. Let's get rid of war. Well, we still have plague, famine, and war. Well, why? All those things are optional. We can solve those things. Harari suggests even death is optional. It's just a hardware glitch. You didn't die because of God's will. You didn't die because of the fall or original sin, loss of original justice. You died because your heart stopped, and we can fix that. Let's get some pig valves going to fix the heart. Okay, Bill McClay adds into that, suddenly, this conversation. We should stride out into the world as sort of masters of the universe. There's no God. There's no forces beyond, in principle, our control. It's just that we don't know the principles yet, or we haven't funded the principles yet, or the scientist hasn't figured out the principles yet. Why are there floods? We didn't build a dam. Why is there disease? We haven't discovered a cure. So whenever anything goes wrong, it's our fault. It's somebody's fault. And as a result, McClay suggests, and I think this is correct, rather than experiencing ourselves as we might, which is a sort of Francis Bacon or Machiavellian sense that the world and nature and fortune can be bent to our will, we're the Ubermensch who control our fates. We're in fact racked with anxiety that something wrong has happened, which we could have precluded or solved, but we didn't. So it's our fault. So rather than entering the world like conquering heroes, we're racked with anxiety, consumed with safetyism, consumed with fear, anxiety, and so on. So McClay has a line, rather than the Ubermensch, we become obsessive compulsive hand washers. Because if I get sick, it's my fault. I should have used, the Purell to get the germs off my hands, and I didn't. And it's not God's will. It's my fault.
Yeah. There's a sort of Pelagianism sort of lurking in the background there.
Yeah, and it's true then when it comes to human well-being, human flourishing, what you might think of as a kind of false vision of hope, charity, and faith. It's all up to me. It's Pelagian. And if I don't have it, well, I should have willed and thought better, shouldn't I?
Your third of these three malaises you call a failure of hope, which you describe as moderns who see things without superstition and with clear-headed realism. They take themselves to be the sole source of intentionality and value, but at the same time, ontological rubbish, an accident of the universe, their intentions random and without value. So there's sort of a paradox or contradiction or how would you describe it? How are they able to hold these together, these two fundamentally conflicting ideas together in their minds?
I just finished teaching a class with some very bright students, some of whom are happy to admit that they are ontological, epistemological, and material reductionists. We're just matter in motion. We're just brains. And brains are just neurons, and neurons are just chemicals. Okay. At the same time, though, they're arguing fairly strongly, maybe even vociferously, for notions like human dignity, human rights, and human value. Well, square that circle.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how you square that circle. At the point where there is, as the only source of meaning in the universe, us, the human. But the human is easily explained and perhaps best explained by neurons, which is just chemical, which is just physics, which is just energy. I'm not sure how you find a defense of things where there is such a thing as human dignity. You can give human rights if by human rights you mean something like what we all around here agree to.
Mm-hmm.
But what would you do if someone said, I disagree, I don't value human rights, we're just energy and force, and I'm going to use energy and force to trample over your human rights? Even your arguments against such things are just neurons, which is just energy. Your quest to discover the truth of the thing is an evolutionary impulse. It has no value. We are, in the universe, just ontological rubbish. We're just bits of matter that have floated together with no permanent identity, no soul, no value from God. The universe is cold and stark. There's no value to it. If the universe snuffed out of existence, nothing would change in terms of value. So how is it that we view ourselves in a universe which is cold, empty, stark, and does not care, and yet we have value and worth and dignity? I don't see how you can square that circle. And we're trapped by immanence in being the sole bearers of value while simultaneously removing any legitimacy to ourselves to bear that value or to be its source.
Do they fall back on, in their attempt to square the circle, fall back on a sort of Kantian categorical imperative that, okay, maybe there isn't objectively anything about human dignity, but I want to be treated with dignity, so therefore I'm going to just treat other people with dignity?
It tends in that conversation to be relatively equally split between utilitarians who have a kind of calculus for this and Kantians. The problem, of course, is for the Kantian, I don't want to be treated this way. Maybe I can universalize that to give you a rule. Whatever you think about the inner logic of Kant's position, it's non-responsive, I think, to the person who says, good for you that you don't want to be treated that way. I have a kind of Nietzschean vitalism, and I believe in the will to power, and I would like to universalize that, and it turns out I'm stronger and faster and smarter than you. So I win, you lose, and you can keep talking with human dignity all you want. But in the end, my force overwhelms your logic and I win. And not only is that true in a sort of practical sense, right? The Kantian argument is powerless against that kind of force, but the logic itself doesn't work because there's no reason to give value to logic, right? If the world is just matter in motion, why should we privilege, value, believe logic? It's an accident of the way the brain was constructed through the accident of evolution. Does it tend to allow, you know, the building of a better and bigger toaster if we follow logic? Sure, it works. It's advantageous to certain aspects of evolution that we follow logic. But is it correct or true or right or valuable to follow logic? No, there's no reason to believe that. And for the utilitarian, yeah, it's just special pleading. Sure, we tend to like pleasure and dislike pain. How you get to that pleasure is a good thing to be morally valued, and pain is a bad thing to be morally disvalued in a world in which there are no moral values or disvalues, just doesn't work. I think they're up a creek without a paddle.
So, but there is a sort of response to these three malaises of modernity. In the next several chapters, you talk about these, what you call three visions of false hope, a certain type of humanitarianism, political rationalism, and false attempts to re-enchant the world. So why don't we sort of take those one by one? The first one, again, humanitarianism. What's wrong with humanitarianism? Isn't that nice? Give money and be nice to people and help the poor.
Yeah,
What's your critique, Dr. Snell?
Who doesn't love the UN millennial goals?
Exactly.
Yeah, good. So I'm borrowing the language here from the contemporary French political theorist Pierre Menard, who I really like. Humanitarianism here does not mean humanitarian aid. We're not talking about sending, you know, clean water to Gaza or military assistance to Ukraine or peacekeepers to Haiti, right? Just to think of some flashpoints in the world right now. We're not talking about corporal and spiritual works of mercy. Nothing like that. Here's Menent's argument, and I think it's an interesting and a true one. He gives a long story. I'll try to be brief.
He thinks that one of the things that the West has struggled with in its history is the changing of political form. So in the ancient world, you have the city-state, the polis, Athens versus Sparta. It's a thick community which includes its citizens, but it makes no pretensions to universality. If you're a Spartan, you're very definitely not an Athenian. If you're an Athenian, you're very definitely not from Corinth. Socrates is invited to flee Athens and save his life. And he says, what am I going to go do? Go live elsewhere? You can't flourish there, right? Those are barely human places. Well, that gets replaced by the empire, by the Roman Empire. Well, empire is strange because it has a kind of universality to it. It's the known world, let's say. But it doesn't view itself like the polis as a universal community. So you might be a member, you might be under the rule of the Roman Empire, but you're not a citizen of Rome. And you're allowed to keep your local divinities. You're allowed to have your local forms of life. You're allowed to keep your language. Right? Historically, it was the Jews who stood out so odd to the Roman Empire because they wouldn't just play along. They could have kept their religion. All they have to do is, you know, pour a libation to Caesar. What's the problem? So it's universal, but it doesn't have, in a sense, local political content the way that the polis does. The church claims universality. It's open to all in principle, right? Neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, slave nor free, go into all nations and baptize. It's universal. But not everyone belongs to the church. They're welcome to belong, but not everyone does. Okay, the Enlightenment hits. You realize that this is the claim that Manent makes, is that the Enlightenment thinkers conclude, well, the church didn't work. We like its universality, but the Reformation and the wars of religion and the failure of the church to govern the papal states very well and the failure of the church get to Asia to sort of take root in Asia belies its claim. So we want to have a universality. Well, what's the option? The universality is humanity itself. So I look at you and what I recognize in you is humanity, but I don't recognize you as Christian or as male or as married to this person, or as having this creed, this language, this history, this nationality. You're just human qua human. So the object which we are going to recognize, respect, and venerate is capital H humanity, humanity qua humanity. But that humanity, while it's universal and all people should be respected, that's the humanitarian part, has no content. So it's universal in extension and empty in intention. So if I start to define humanity as having any real content, I start to exclude somebody, right? So if I want to say, well, humanity is European, well, I've excluded most of the world. If I want to say humanity is male, I've started to exclude half the world, probably a little more than half the world. If I start to privilege English speaking, well, obviously I've removed most of the world. So any content that I give to humanity becomes exclusionary. And so now what I'm going to recognize, venerate, and adore is humanitarianism itself, which is the good of humanity qua humanity with no content. Okay, good. What am I to serve? Any real or dense or substantive good of the human is going to be disagreed about. So there can't be any actual substantive vision of the good that I'm seeking, except something like human rights, which is just nothing more than the recognition of humanity itself as an object of veneration and adoration without content. Manent suggests what we'll get is a negative policy, a negative politics. I call it a negative frenzy here. So what becomes the enemy of this kind of humanitarianism? Thick, substantive visions of the good. This is sort of like Rawls on steroids, right? If you have a comprehensive viewpoint, it claims that others are less true. We can't have that. So what is it I'm going to have as a politics? Anything which is emancipatory or liberates us from substance. So think about justice. If I have a vision of justice which looks a lot like the kingdom of God, that's a substantial view which excludes somebody's viewpoint. So I can't have that as my view of justice. All I can really have is a negative view that injustice is bad and we should free people from injustice. For what? We don't know. We know that repression is bad, but we don't know what freedom is. We know that heteronomy is bad, but we don't know what autonomy is. We know that injustice is bad, but we don't know what justice is. And so we get a politic and a commitment to undo, critique, and unmask all substantial forms of life in the name of humanity for which there is no content. That is in principle irresolvable and has no point at which we'll ever come to a conclusion. I make reference to Derrida's notion of messianicity. Derrida says, look, we're sort of praying for the messianic age when all things shall be well. But if the Messiah actually came, we'd have this scandal of particularity. It would be this guy, not that guy, who's the Messiah. And he would make this teaching, not that teaching. And he would say, this is the truth and that is false. So the worst thing that could ever happen is an actual Messiah, because it would be exclusionary and violent to others. So you pray for the messianic age as you simultaneously pray that no real Messiah will come. That's messianicity. Well, that's humanitarianism. We hope for a golden age where all humans are free to define themselves, where there is no suffering. There is no loneliness. There isn't been no, I'm trying to say negations. There's just an absence of bad things, but we don't know what's good.
So what's more dangerous about this humanitarianism? Is it that it's simply shallow, or that it lacks a telos, or both? Which would you say is more bothersome to you?
Well, I think it's fundamentally dishonest in part. So for instance, Rawls, I think Rawls, both early and late Rawls is different from the early on this. The Rawls is smuggling in an anthropology and an ethics, claiming that he doesn't. Right, it's just rational self-interest and fairness. But of course, that depends upon a smuggled in, hidden in the cover of darkness vision of what the good life is, or what is harmful, what's true, what's good, how we ought to live. It's just not articulated and defended. So it's fundamentally a kind of deceit, which I think is a kind of violence, actually. So if you think about a lot of our current politics, we value pluralism. Well, because we value pluralism, there's a sense in which we value democracy. That's good, I think, in the main. But that pluralism is itself a value which smuggles in claims that real truth claims are false. Let me give an example. Cardinal Scola wrote a book a few years ago called Let's Not Forget God. I think that was the title. It was a series of lectures, pretty short. He asked the question, well, what does secularity mean? Well, when we describe secularity, it's generally described as we just don't privilege or empower the views of religion. Religion is another voice among many. But is that really what secularity is? No. He says that in order to actually get a view of secularity, it's not that we are a-religious, it's that we're irreligious. What we actually claim is religion is not worth thinking about. It doesn't make truth claims. It's irrational. It's merely subjective. All of which trains the citizen, and especially the young, to think that religion is false, capricious, irrational, meaningless, and not worth thinking about, which is not secularity, but a kind of privilege for atheism. It's not secular at all. It's a positive vision of atheism, or a positive vision of that irreligion is good. That's what I think humanitarianism does as well. Its dishonesty is a kind of falsely enforced morality while claiming that it's not a moral code and doesn't enforce anything. Well, no thanks. Don't sign me up for that. I'd rather have the argument and know what I'm against.
The second of three visions of false hope you describe as political rationalism. How do you define that, and what makes it a false hope?
So I'm borrowing here from Michael Oakeshott's famous essay, Rationalism in Politics, which as the years go on and as I get old, makes a lot more sense to me than it used to. And I think it's more all-encompassing than it used to be. I used to think it was just directed towards the left. I now think that he's correct, that rationalism in politics has infected all the political parties, not merely the left, where the old arguments were that it was about. So what's rationalism? Don't think Descartes or Spinoza or Leibniz. Don't think of a philosophical period of rationalism. Don't think of a privileging of geometrical form of arguments where we have an axiom and we deduce to necessarily invalid conclusions, okay? Not that. It's like that, but it's not that per se. He says that if you want to understand rationalism in politics, you should instead think of a sketch of a character type or a mood or a disposition that people have. And the disposition of the rationalist in politics, he says, is that they are impatient with imperfection. They are impatient with temporality. They very much dislike the idea that human politics takes time and is slow and requires compromise, development, education, formation, imperfection, and difference. So the rationalist wants a politics as if from a God's eye view. It's a politics of totality and uniformity. If we just followed reason, we'd realize here are the principles of politics. Now it's just a problem of administration. But we know what's good because reason tells us what's good. We can critique all the superstitions, all the particularities, all the religions, all the differences to get what's universally true. So every political conclusion should be the same. Everybody should get it. And now we just need to do it. And if we can do it, we need to do it now. And if we can do it now, and if it's universal, there's no reason to not have it encompass everything about human life. We shouldn't leave anything outside of political control. No civil society, no privacy for religion, no privacy for the family, no privacy for all those weird little clubs, the Lions Club and the Knights of Columbus to do their weird little things. We have rational principles. Those need to be enforced. And we loathe difference and we detest imperfection in politics. So what do we want? We want heaven on earth. When do we want it? Now. How do we get it? Political action, which we know how to do, and political action does it admits of no insecurity or no difficulties, really. So think about the line from Aristotle from the early pages of the Nicomachean Ethics. Aristotle says, the well-schooled man knows that you don't ask for probability from a geometer and you don't ask for certainty from a rhetorician. The geometer is wrong if he says the one angle is 43 degrees. It's not. It's 45. It's the only way it can be is 45. Whereas you ask the rhetorician or the politician, how do we guarantee a fair tax policy which solves all the problems of immigration, inflation, and housing? Yeah, that's not going to happen. You have probabilities. Some ideas are good, some ideas are bad. And it turns out mostly what we do is muddle along. Something works for a while, then it stops working and we try again. That's not to suggest that there's not truth in politics. It's not a free-for-all. It's not just utility. It's to suggest that in politics, there is the truth of action, which is incredibly concrete. And that concreteness is very difficult. So the joke that I make in the book is, it's actually much easier to be a physicist than a statesman. I can't do either. But it's actually much easier to be a physicist than a statesman. And the proof of that is there's a lot more competent physicists than there are competent statesmen. Because to be a statesman is really hard. Mm. And you have to know the truth, not of generalities, but of the specific actions, which includes the intransigent reality of human freedom. And the rationalist wants to run roughshod over that and get us to perfection now.
That reminds me, that chapter reminds me of a phrase I recently heard that kind of just sticks in my mind. When you reject metaphysics, all you're left with is politics.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
In this postmodern age, that's what we've done. So what is on the cover of every newspaper every day? It's politics, because that's all you're left with.
And politics is everything. The personal is the political is the personal. But we also want it to be as rigorous and demanding and certain as the old metaphysics. Like if you confuse the distinction between substance and accident, you've got it wrong. Yeah. But think about how we talk politically, right? The person who disagrees is wicked, evil, and wrong. It's not that they have a reasonable disagreement within real options that are uncertain about a concrete political action. Now, I don't think everything is uncertain, but there's a whole lot in politics which is uncertain. It reasonably could be done this way. It reasonably could be done that way. And you're neither evil nor wicked nor stupid to think that, because there's uncertainty.
The third of your false hopes you call false attempts to re-enchant the world, and you list several soft and hard varieties of neo-paganism, which we already sort of hinted at, weird Christianity, mainstream Christianity that embraces the vision of the sacramental imagination without believing in the actual sacraments, and political fantasies. So what do you mean by false attempts to re-enchant the world?
Yeah, this is the chapter that all my friends say, oh, you just want to lose all your friends, because everybody is. I don't have any friend who've read that chapter who hasn't said, hey, why are you attacking me?
Right.
which I'm not trying to attack anything. So, well, I guess I am. That's probably not true. I am trying to critique. It seems natural and perfectly understandable to me that if Taylor and others are at all correct, that we are suffering under conditions of disenchantment, that we might want to weigh out a disenchantment. That makes perfect sense to me. Well, it seems to me that many of the articulations about how to re-enchant the world are not going to be reasonable options. They're going to be quasi-idolatrous or false or ersatz or trying to gussy up something that I don't think they can deliver. And I think there's a variety of forms, and I'm sure it's not exhaustive here. So one of my concerns in this chapter is if we're going to reenchant the world, and there's a whole bunch of literature that's out or soon to come out. Like I think Rod Dreher has a book coming out soon on reenchantment. Oh,
okay. Yeah.
I don't know what he says. I haven't read the book, so I don't have him particularly in mind. But there's all these attempts to reenchant the world. What I'm concerned about is any attempt which makes us feel as if the world is enchanting. It's a feeling. Mm-hmm. Or we've convinced ourselves that there's something going on, which is kind of cool, but we don't actually have a genuine metaphysic or a genuine ontology or epistemology, which is true. So soft and hard paganism. Soft paganism, you know, crystals in the psychic down at Malibu Beach. It's kind of soft, right? It's kind of a vague spirituality.
About 20 minutes from here.
or maybe it's not Malibu. Maybe it's Venice. Maybe it's the pier at Venice Beach. That's where that is, actually.
It's all over in Southern
it's
California.
It's all over the place. Okay. Or hard paganism, right? Like the recovery of Germanic and Norse religion, right? All these guys naming their kids Thor and, you know, going out in the woods to worship Woden or something. Well, those are all false. They might give you a sense of meaning, but it turns out there is no Odin. He doesn't exist. Right. So that's just false. Or weird Christianity. I'm relying here on the really interesting work of Tara Isabella Burton and a shorter essay by Julia Yost. I think it's Yost who uses the phrase dime square Catholicism. So dime square Catholicism, right? It's a reference to New York. And you can find people in New York, she says, who are sort of like, this is my phrase, not her, kind of Vatican I atheists. Which I think is sort of funny. Like they love the Latin Mass and they love chapel veils and they love incense, but they don't believe in God.
Mm.
So they kind of show up at Mass and, well, this is so weird. And there's Gregorian chant and Latin is creepy and it's ethereal and it makes me feel something. Well, is there a God? Oh, yeah, no, of course not. But I kind of like wearing a traditional bit of garb because it's not so lame and bourgeois and flat. Like I've escaped the world of Best Buy and Target, and I'm into a world which seems denser and richer, and there's feasts and fasts and candles and incense and monks. Well, is there a God? No. Well, you know, that's not so helpful. That's a kind of spiritual tourism. And I suspect like a drug use, the dopamine hit goes down and you move on to something else pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Like you're going to go from dime square Catholicism, right? Vatican I atheism to, I don't know, Buddhism soon after. You probably try Kabbalah soon after that. And, you know, you go from experience to experience. I think that's a fake story of enchantment. You're trying to feel enchanted as opposed to in recovering an enchanted universe in which there's a God who pours forth from his endless creativity and generosity world, which is good. Mainline Christianity, which kind of wants a sacramental-ish world. Look, I had my Tolkien phase too. I love Tolkien. I love Tolkien.
Yeah.
I had my Narnia phase too. I love C.S. Lewis. But there is a kind of reader of Tolkien or Lewis who thinks the wardrobe is amazing. Let's re-narrate a world of story and enchantment and fiction. Like they'll read Tolkien on fairy stories. And Tolkien's pretty explicit. Fairy stories aren't to be read literally. There aren't gnomes. There aren't trolls. There aren't fairies hiding under bridges and behind the mushroom. If you go looking for them, there's nothing there. Mythopoesis is myth to reveal poetically what is in fact actual in reality. I think this version of enchantment wants the myth without the poesis that points to what's real. So the image I give here is people who kind of long for a sacramental worldview, but don't believe in the sacraments.
Mm.
So the joke, maybe it's a joke, is they want the wardrobe without the tabernacle. Wardrobe here, reference to Narnia. Tabernacle with reference to the Eucharist. They'd think it's just bread up there. What I genuflect to, there's nothing there. It's just bread.
Yeah.
But it's cool enough to give us a narrative or literary story where we act and pretend as if it allows us something like the world of Tolkien or Lewis or Charles, who's the other inkling? Charles Williams, but without believing in the precondition and grounds which make any of those stories possible. I think that's kind of a vaccination against real religiosity, against real religion. You get kind of the benefits of it without having to believe.
To your friend's points when they said, why are you attacking me? One of the other things that you talk about in that chapter is neo-traditionalism, which you describe, and you don't mention this as a specific example, but I'm wondering if you would include this in neo-traditionalism, and that is the recent classical school movement, which I'm a big fan of. And so when that thought popped into my head, I thought, well, why is he attacking me? What's wrong with the classical school movement? So can you talk about neo-traditionalism? Would you include the classical school movement in that? And why are you attacking me?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, my own kids are reading Plutarch and Shakespeare today. Let's all be friends, right? So here's one of the oddities. So I'm a very traditional person. You know, I'm a Roman Catholic. I believe that tradition is a source of, I believe, Dei Verbum, right? We have scripture and we have tradition, and that's revelation too. I'm traditional in my religious and moral views, marriage, abortion, whatever, right? So, but there's an oddity to neo-traditionalism, which I think just needs to be acknowledged and confronted, which is the following. Tradition in the old saw is the living faith of the dead, not the dead faith of the living. When we enter into cultural conditions where it seems like the center can't hold, everything's chaotic and run aground, and that even the old traditions no longer feel as if they're lively or sources of wisdom, or there's not authority behind them, it's very natural to the human, at least some for some people, of course, not everybody. Some people will look to the future, other people look to the back, whatever. It's very natural for some humans to say, well, this is awful, let's go back. But there's a kind of oddity we just need to confront, which is tradition is not so, genuine and full tradition is not so self-aware of itself. This is a silly example, but it's one that resonates with me. When my dear grandmother passed away, she and I were very close. One of the things I did before the cousins got there, I hope they don't listen to this, but before the cousins got there is I went and took a few things that I wanted before they got there, but not like jewelry and gold, you know, nothing that was of value. I went and took her recipe box, which was like 3x5 cards scrawled out. I wanted her recipe for Nepfle and Kuchen and pierogi. And it went something like this, some of the recipes. Fill the blue bowl and stir until the consistency is correct. Well, what's the blue bowl? Where's the blue bowl? I don't know how much that is. Like her pierogi were great, but like, I couldn't make the pierogi from the recipe.
Right.
So when I try to make the recipe, it's much more self-conscious for me. Where's the blue bowl? What's like the blue bowl? And there's a sense in which tradition is a background condition for action. We don't have to call it so consciously to mind. So, you know, as we're recording this, it's Holy Thursday. I don't know when it'll come out, but my wife and some of my children are going to go visit 7 repositories tonight, which is an old tradition, and particularly alive in Philadelphia still. There'll be buses of parishioners all over Philadelphia tonight going to 7 churches. Well, nobody really thinks about it like, hey, let's have a cool tradition and all get in a bus and go to 7 parishes. It's just what you do.
Yeah.
Neo-traditionalism forgets sometimes that it's neo. And so it is trying. And when it's trying, immediately you start to argue about it. So think about one of the tensions you get in classical education. Well, is this real classical education, or did Dorothy Sayers make this up? Does it all need to be done in Latin, or can we read the books in translation? Can we read a book that's written after 1980 or not? Like, all the debates occur immediately because we're trying to, in a sense, create, reconstitute, recover what earlier generations found more obvious. So am I against classical schooling? Yeah, of course not. I think it's a great idea to read the old books and to read them well. I think we can recover all sorts of things. But let's not forget the oddity of trying to reinvent something that for our ancestors was more obvious than it is for us. And for us, we have to try harder. There's a stance we're taking, which is an optional stance, and we know is optional. And because we know it's optional, we're a little more fragile and defensive about it. Genuine, lively tradition is not so defensive because it's, in a sense, how the world is, how everyone sees the world, the option. I think Taylor's right. Those of us who are believe in tradition, we look over our shoulders and we're aware that what we're doing is an option, not the option. And so we're in an odd position relative to tradition when we're the ones holding it and sustaining it in a more overt choice.
So if you are a principal of a K-12 classical school, is the issue, how would you be the principal differently of that school? Is it simply an issue of we have to do something a little bit different than what most classical schools are doing? Or would you say we just need to have a different attitude or different approach, a different mindset than the way these other schools are doing it.
I just think we have to acknowledge that we're not doing something which is unbroken.
Mm.
Like the continuity is broken.
Right.
We're not doing something which is self-evident to most people. And as a result, we're in the odd position of needing to explain, define, and defend what we're doing in a way that they didn't used to need to do. Like, if you're doing, if you're Thomas Aquinas and you're at the Benedictine Monastery as a young man getting trained, no one is sort of saying, I wonder what the tradition is. Which book should we read? What's the trivium?
Yeah.
Let's read Dorothy Sayers to figure out what that is. Now, is Sayers meaning this seriously? Do we really only do the grammar phase till sixth grade? And then we really only do the logic phase till ninth grade? And then we only do the rhetorical? Like, that's not how it worked.
Yeah.
So I think we just have to admit that the classical tradition in education for us now is not the classical tradition. It's not the classical education. It's a recovery. And so what I take to be a lot of the internecine battles within the classical movement of, no, that's not real classical education. That's because of the oddity of our situation. And we probably shouldn't be such purists about it.
Well, I'd love to keep talking about that, but I don't want to go down that tangent too much farther. Let's bring it back to the third final section of your book, where you offer some paths of recovering hope. You talk about dynamic ontology, a supple cognitional theory, and the virtue of hope. Again, let's take that one by one. So what do you mean by dynamic ontology?
Good. So just to position this somewhat. So, by the final chapter, I'm articulating what I take to be the Christian view, which is that hope is a gift, is a theological virtue. It's a gift of the Holy Spirit. It's not an acquired virtue the way that courage might be, but it's an infused virtue. So we can't acquire hope on our own. It's a gift of God. Okay, but can we clear the paths of the Lord, as it were? Can we get in the streams of grace, not to gussy up genuine theological virtue of hope in ourselves, but at least to sort of stay out of the way or not put up roadblocks? And so real good ontology, good cognitional theory, sort of get out of the way so we can appreciate and understand the real virtue of hope when it arrives. Sort of a John the Baptist ministry for Christ when he arrives kind of notion. Okay, dynamic ontology. The earlier sections of the book articulate the vision, I'm using Hans Jonas here, of what early modern science does to the Aristotelian world. The Aristotelian world is one in which there's thick teleology. That's just gone in early modern science. And in fact, early modern science understands its success, its ability to give us antibiotics and the internet. Its success is in part because it rejected or excluded teleology from the conversation. But it even, in a sense, gets rid of formal causality from the conversation. It's not really concerned with what things are or the essence of things. It's concerned with the matter of things and the efficient cause of things, how things work, not what they are. And how things work, certainly not what they are for. So the Aristotelian tradition, and throw evolution on top of that, where we don't even have stable essences because they develop over time. There's not a fixed human nature. It's humanity as we have defined it just now in an ongoing series of flux, which is developing and wasn't the same in the past and won't be the same in the future. How in the world do we have a metaphysics or an ontology which is vaguely Aristotelian or even vaguely Thomistic after modern science and after evolution without sort of attempting to live in the 13th century and not being responsive to things which appear to be true, at least to our interlocutors. So I'm trying to give a read of an early work of Aquinas, De Ente et Essentia, which is very complicated. It's not very long, but boy, is it dense. And I'm trying to articulate that in Thomas, we can have an understanding of the world where the world is in fact not static and fixed, but generative. But generative doesn't mean in chaos or in flux or without stability or without nature or essence. So to try and explain that, I make reference to the order that we get in Genesis 1. These are not like perfect analogies or something. I don't think Genesis 1 is giving us a Thomistic metaphysic or something, right? But it's explained. What do we get? Well, we get form and content distinction, or form and matter distinction, if you want, in Genesis 1. What's created first? Light. But there's no lights yet. Then what's created? Well, we separate waters from waters. But what don't we have yet? Matter. We don't have fish and fowl. And then we separate water from land, but we don't have vegetation or creeping things or the human yet. So we get form, light, let's say, and that form is open to, maybe this is awfully poetic, but awaiting or disposed to particular instances or matter to fill that form, the sun, the moon, and the stars. We get the water separated from the waters, that's form, but what's it open to? What is it awaiting? What is it well disposed to? Fish and fowl. We get land and we get sea. What is that disposed to? That's disposed to vegetation, animals, and the human. Or I take as quite beautiful the imagery where God molds earth and then breathes into it life. Adam, I take that as something which is in principle open to an understanding where the universe, even if there's an emergent probability from lower forms, let's say just physics to chemicals, from chemicals to biology, where the emergent probability of the world allows for dynamism and emergence, let's say an evolutionary world, if you want. I don't mean strict Darwinism here because there's parts of Darwin that I wouldn't accept, but an evolutionary view of the world where we go from just matter in motion to star clusters to life. And that Thomas wouldn't disagree, that it's not all just fixed static essences out there in the world with no change. Now, if Thomistic metaphysics allows for a kind of fecundity in the universe, then we don't need to have a reductive view of science where everything is merely matter in motion, not oriented towards life and meaning, not disposed to human consciousness and human value. It is disposed to human value. It is disposed to God at work in the world. But we also don't need to reject modern science and its benefits. We can have both. We can have our cake and eat it too. We can avoid deflationary reductionism and radical immanence without needing to, in a sense, believe in pre-modern science and only pre-modern science.
So the other two, I believe, is supple cognitive theory and the virtue of hope. How do I want to say this, sort of integration or connection between those three, the dynamic ontology, supple cognitive theory, a virtue of the hope? How do those three sort of relate to each other?
Here's maybe the short way of putting it, drawing on the work of Luigi Giussani, who I've really learned to admire and love. He's one of the originators of the Communion Liberation Movement, for what it's worth. I don't know much about CNL, but I think Giussani's great. And Ratzinger's famous Regensburg Address, that could be the starting point. And it's something like this. If we are not reductive and reductionistic in our metaphysics, it means that there's more than one level or density or type of reality. Think Thomas. We have composite beings and we have non-composite beings. There's a difference between the human constitution and the angelic constitution, which is in itself different from the divine constitution. God is pure act. Angels are not pure act, but they don't have bodies. Humans are not pure act, and we also have bodies. The world of value, ethics, and politics are different from the world of science. It doesn't mean they're not real or merely subjective or just arbitrary. It's just not science. Science can't tell us what's ethical. It doesn't mean that ethics is false. So here's a way to put it. Reality is polymorphic. It has more than one shape. And so reason needs to be polyvalent. Reality is polymorphic, so reason needs to be polyvalent. We need more than one method of reason in order to understand all that is real. But that is not a defense of irrationality or a defense of whimsy or merely authority or subjectivism or wishful thinking. So in the Regensburg Address, Ratzinger suggests one of the tasks for people of biblical faith is to recover for the world a full account of reason. Isn't that interesting? Not that we need to recover faith. We need to recover a full account of reason.
Yeah.
The way Giussani puts it, reason is not so arthritic. Meaning it's not just scientific method. It's not just math. It's not just logic. It includes the world of philosophy, the world of ethics, right? That's the full range of reason. So reality is polymorphic. So reason needs to be polyvalent. So we have a dynamic ontology, which includes more than just matter in motion, although it does include matter in motion. So we need reason, which is capable of dealing with matter in motion, but capable of dealing with more than matter in motion. All of which kind of gets out of the way. So we anticipate and can know a world which is not merely immanent, but where there is the transcendent and we're open to the acts of God, we're open to the works of God, and we thus don't interfere with the gift of grace, and particularly hope, which is defined as an anticipation that God can, in fact, and will, in fact, deliver the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven.
Reminds me of Chesterton's claim, the madman is not the man who's lost his reason. It's the man who's lost everything but his reason.
Yep. Yeah. He only has logic. That's all there is. Yeah. And so everything goes away. Or another way, put another line from Chesterton. I don't know where this is exactly, where he says, you know, modernity tried to knock the mitre off the Pope, right? Try to get rid of religion, but ended up knocking off the head as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So in order to try and save reason from religion, what they ended up doing was killing reason because they made it too small. Same point, I think.
Anything else you want to say about these paths of recovery of hope before we move on?
Yeah, I don't think we can gussy up hope. Having a good metaphysics isn't the same thing as hope. Having a good epistemology isn't the same thing as hope. Like getting your worldview right is not the theological virtue of hope.
Yeah.
So this is not a matter of just thinking or willing ourselves into virtue. But we certainly can remove impediments. But at the end of the day, hope is a gift of God. It's an act of the Holy Spirit, which gives us a full and real virtue, which allows us to flourish not only in eternal life, but to flourish now.
Just a couple of final questions. What prompted you to write this book?
Some of this comes from a summer course that I've done, probably 6 or 7 years now, through Witherspoon, called First Principles. It's a 2-week course. I teach metaphysics and epistemology in week one, while another professor teaches political theory as it relates to liberal education. There's a kind of relationship there. Week two, I do ethics and action theory, and another professor does friendship and sexual morality. And the questions that students were asking me and what they were receptive to and hesitant to accept prompted the book. So I really am writing this. And my kind of ideal audience I have in mind is an energetic, enthused, honest, but nonetheless confused college student who can't see their way past a reductive universe and feel a kind of despair and disgruntlement with that universe.
There are a lot of those people.
There's
out there.
There's a lot of those
sell
people
a lot of
out
books.
There.
You're gonna get rich off this one.
Yeah, yeah. If only they'd buy it, I can retire early to write other books. Yeah, that's the audience, though. It's a genuine concern for the most well-intentioned, intelligent, and earnest people that I know can't get their way out of that trapped apartment from the days of abandonment, the fellow I referred to.
Final question. I always like to end on a note of hope. We are a people of hope, specifically hope in the resurrection, as you pointed out, will be this coming Sunday. Of course, the last third of your book is about hope, this sort of offering paths of recovering hope. So for you, my question is a question of hope about hope. So what gives you hope that our society might actually be able to recover hope as you describe it in that last chapter, the last chapters of your book?
So the first chapter about Elena Ferrante's fiction, her fiction is all about women and the destruction of women. So it's pretty glum, the chapter. It's no accident that the epilogue, whatever it is about Mary, where we have a woman who in her fiat becomes the cooperator with hope and the means of hope for us all. Here's how I put it. Here's how I think about it. Hope is a properly theological virtue, but I do think there are natural analogs to it. And I do think that hope is not merely pie in the sky, subjective disposition of cheerfulness and optimism. Like things are going to be great. Things are going to be great. Just kind of will your way into it. I think when hope is given, and it really can be given by God so that we can be people of hope, it's a genuine virtue, which is not merely about the afterlife and about getting to heaven and the kingdom of God. It's certainly that, and that's the core of hope. But because it's a real virtue, it's a perfection. Any virtue is a perfection of the human relative to that virtue. Courage makes us perfect with reference to our fears. Moderation makes us perfect with reference to our appetites. Hope, I think, when we have it, frees up intelligence and frees up human action to do as it ought to do. So I won't give the complicated version of that, but here's a short story or a short anecdote I like. I'm getting the details wrong, but something like this. New College, Oxford, I think, was founded in 1347. Sometime in the 1800s, they discovered that the huge oaken beams in the dining hall were being consumed by beetles. They were becoming beetly, I guess is the phrase. And so they realized they needed new beams. They couldn't find any trees in England that were large enough to be the oaken beams. They're just these massive, massive beams, and there were no trees. So they're searching all over the place. They can't find them. And one day they call in the college gardener. He says to them, "What do you mean? The college planted those trees in 1347. They're on the college grounds." They planted them at the time of the building, knowing that all beams in the end get beetly and rotten.
Yeah.
And so we have the trees ready to go. Well, what were they doing? Well, they built in expectation that they would be there, not in 1348 or 1349, but they would be there in 1889.
Yeah.
Well, that frees up intelligence to take the long view. That frees up intelligence to not be stricken with the short term, with the immediate, with panic, all of which makes us think poorly and bad and to be self-serving and act out of panic.
Mm.
So I think that what hope allows us to do, here's just another natural analog. And a lot of this book is about why I think politics is out of whack, because it's too totalizing, too frantic.
Right.
It allows us to not think about merely the next election cycle. It allows us to think, what would intelligence demand of us for the well-being of my great-great-grandchildren's friends? I put it that way because not just my great-great-grandchildren. I have a special interest in them, yeah?
Sure.
But in my great-great-grandchildren's friends. Well, that's a natural analog to hope because it's not optimism. Things might go really bad. The world might end. We may have a demographic collapse and there are no great-great-grandchildren, right? It kind of looks that way, actually.
Right.
But hope operates as if there are responsibilities for things long in the future and that our intelligence can work in that direction if we free ourselves from the tyranny of the immediate and the panic. So I think that people of hope, people of the theological virtue of hope, have a unique place in our society to demonstrate a natural, ordinary human virtue of patience, long-term thought, genuine policy, sacrifice, and so on. And that, in fact, is a reason to believe that people of hope, including people of faith, maybe primarily people of faith, can show a better way.
Again, the book is called Lost in the Chaos, Imminence, Despair, Hope by Angelico Press, written by Dr. R.J. Snell. Dr. Snell, thank you so much for joining me. I really enjoyed this conversation and this book as well. I definitely think to your point about your intended audience, there are plenty of people out there that fit that description, and we need to get this book in the hands of all those people. So thank you so much for joining me, and more importantly, thank you so much for writing this book.
Thank you for the conversation, and you know, my appreciation that you've obviously read the book. You know, that doesn't always happen in an interview, so I appreciate the time that you've put into reading and preparing as well. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I don't know how anybody would ever have an interview they don't read the book, but it happens. So it baffles me, but it does. Thank you again. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Our culture is in a crisis, and the solution to that crisis is the gospel message. St. John's Seminary, the seminary of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, offers an online MA in pastoral ministry degree for anyone interested in receiving formation for ministry. This program helps students improve their knowledge of the Catholic intellectual tradition and develop practical skills for ministry. A studio with professional video, audio, and lighting equipment allows our students to have an enjoyable technological experience, a necessity for any online learning environment.
Anyone who is working in and around the Roman Catholic Church in North America needs an education like this. There's no way you could get this kind of education anywhere than at a seminary.
Our online Master of Arts in Pastoral Ministry offers you the chance to continue your education in ministry and designed to provide you with the knowledge, spiritual formation, and practical skills that you need to serve the family of God in our parishes, schools, and other ministries.
By grounding yourself in the intellectual tradition of the Catholic Church, you will be able to go out into this culture and leaven it with the good news.